Support for KNKX comes from WSECU, a community credit union with 21 branches and a full suite of digital services. WSECU supports 9 regional farmers markets across Washington State and invites listeners to enjoy the bounty of summer at their local market. More information at WSECU.org.
How would you describe how your back was feeling?
Terrible. I mean, actually out, you could see that my back was not aligned. If you looked at me, I was to the side. I was shifted. And my daughter said, "You should take Pilates." I said, "What's that?"
I'm just going to interrupt here really quick. I'm Gabriel Spitzer. It's Sound Effect. And we're at the Melcorum Family YMCA in Puyallup talking with Chris Lunn.
And so I did. I took the Pilates class and had a great teacher. Well, she had to go and take a straight job, and nobody was left to teach the class. They were going to cancel it. And I said, "I can teach that class." And then all of a sudden, I was a teacher.
So I'll ask the same question that you did when your daughter said that to you. What is Pilates?
Pilates is an extension of a philosophy by a man named Pilates, who was working on various stretches and things to control your core and your back. And it's great for to keep you from falling. And since I'm one of those old guys, that's really important. I don't want to fall. I don't want to hurt myself. And so I'm trying to get stronger and stronger and stronger as I go through.
So if you don't mind an indiscreet question, how old were you when you started teaching Pilates?
70. I started Pilates when I was 70, and I started teaching when I was 75, and I'm 80 now, so I've had about 5 years that I've taught. So,
how many other octogenarian Pilates teachers do you know?
I don't know any, but it's turned out to be a big blessing for me, because now there are senior centers and retirement facilities and that are looking for people who can talk and communicate with 70, 80, and 90-year-olds, which I do teach in other facilities. So that gives me an ability to talk from some of their perspective.
So what has learning Pilates in your 70s and beginning to teach it now as an 80-year-old taught you about learning new things and making changes late in life?
I think it's given me a lot better perspective on life and my learning about myself and my own body, and being careful of where I'm going with myself and learn the techniques that are going to help me and be able to keep me going for a little bit longer. And there are people who teach Pilates and teach yoga that are 100 years old. I don't know how long I can go, but I'm healthy now. I'll just keep at it.
I can see it.
Oh, thank you.
Today on Sound Effect from 88.5, our theme is better late than never. From learning to swim late in life to adults getting real about their own biases. Those stories are just ahead right here on 88.5.
Good. All right. Let's bring those feet down, stomp your feet, roll your back and forth. So now let's take both arms up in the air and put them right up over our head. And we're going to do a snow angel.
This next story opened my eyes to a kind of time pressure that I was always aware of, but I hadn't fully thought through, not being a female in my 30s.
If you're single, you might meet some friends for a glass of wine or out or brunch, and the first thing they'll ask you is, "Are you dating anyone significant?" Or, "How is that guy you were dating? How is that going? Is it serious?" And where this is heading is about, it leads to procreation. Even though the women may not know that, it's exactly what they're asking is, when are you going to procreate?
Marin Landis is 37 years old with a thriving career at Amazon. And she, for one, would like to procreate at some point. It just hasn't happened yet. But now medicine has come up with ways to basically hit the snooze button on the biological clock. A lot of companies love this because the longer female employees delay motherhood, the more they can spend their fertile years working. It is still a bit controversial. But Landis says it's also very liberating for women like her, especially when they're constantly being asked about their biological clock. How often would you say you heard the term biological clock?
Frequently. Weekly, I don't know. Yeah, you hear it on the radio, right? You hear it on TV. You hear it just, it's everywhere. Biological clock is ticking. The pressure is real.
Could you just explain a little bit more, like, what a big difference it is to lift that pressure?
It's like a running conversation in the back of a woman's mind. It's just always going when she's, especially as she's dating, it's just going all the time. And so she's with someone new and she's, the back of her mind is thinking, is he good enough? Is he a provider? It's like all the things that you think about raising a child is going on in her mind when she's trying to get to know this person and see if she even likes him. And so there's a tendency to be like, well, he's tall enough, he's good enough, he's kind enough. And then she might start to kind of pretzel herself or change herself so that she's like, well, this, I can make this work. I can make that work. Sure, we can make this work. But then later on down the line, it really didn't work at all.
How did egg freezing come onto your radar?
So last summer, a good friend of mine from high school lost one of her fallopian tubes and nearly died. It just reduced her chance to get pregnant in the future significantly. And so I was just speaking with my mom about that, about sharing my friend's trauma. And my mom had been a nurse, retired nurse, and she said, why don't you think about egg freezing? This is something that I do need to be aware of, that my healthy eggs have a few years left, and then really I shouldn't have a child through the normal way. So by freezing eggs when I was 36 years old, it stopped that biological clock on those eggs.
So when you made the decision to do this, you had a significant other at the time, right?
Yes, I did. We had been together almost a year.
So how did you open up this subject with your boyfriend?
After I had done this research on my own, I didn't share at this point last summer with him, and I just told him about the process and told him what I wanted to do. Then I invited him to be the hero to the empowered woman that was about to do this. And he got very excited about that. And he was like, what do you need from me? What does support look like? And he was totally on board.
What were the first steps? What did you do and how'd you go about it?
I gave it a name. I gave it a project name. So I called this Project Diamond because I felt like I was growing diamonds in my body. And so it's about a month long thing. The first couple of days, or the first maybe 2 weeks actually, are pretty low key. There's some blood draws that happen. There's also ultrasounds. And then you begin to take, or I took the injectable hormones. It's like a daily injection. And that's really when the eggs begin to grow. And so for me, I think I was typical. I had about 13 eggs beginning to grow. And so you can imagine they're growing in your lower abdomen, uncomfortable. And they're the size of like key limes by the end. So 13 key limes all over there around the ovaries.
Whoa. Well, hang on a second. Yeah. So key lime, that's like a golf ball maybe?
Yeah, exactly.
13 golf balls.
Yes.
But you think of an egg as being like a cell, as being tiny.
Exactly. So there's a little sac around the egg. So you've got this microscopic or barely microscopic egg, and then it's surrounded by fluid sac that was like a harder golf ball size structure.
Wow. So you got 13 golf balls in your abdomen. How did that feel?
A little bit uncomfortable towards the end. Just made like sitting uncomfortable. I just wore like more comfortable clothing, like dresses and stuff. Felt maybe like an early pregnant woman might feel, but the pressure was on the sides of the abdomen instead of where the uterus is in the middle. So it was a little bit awkward. Nothing that was terrible, but I didn't go running. I didn't do any jumping jacks or just anything that was going to like jostle me around too much.
And so once that happened and they extracted the eggs, they mm-hmm. put them in the freezer. I'm sure it's more complicated than that, yeah. but something along those lines.
Yes.
Do you know where they are?
They're here in Seattle.
In a deep freeze somewhere?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Do you think about them ever?
I do think about them sometimes. I pay the rent on their freezer.
You're forced to think about them in that way.
So it's kind of funny.
So to what extent would you say this has quieted that inner monologue that you have in the back of your head that is telling you it's time to get moving?
For me, it has gotten a lot quieter. This is kind of a next threshold for women's empowerment. The birth control pill came to us, you know, earlier this last century, and now this is a new frontier. I do think there's room to improve and improve education about it and reduce the cost of it and just reduce the inconvenience for it. But I think in the future, all women will be doing this. It'll just be something that you do. Maybe you do it sometime after you graduate from college and it just something that is done and it's not a big deal at all. And maybe you do it with your girlfriends and
make a party out of it.
You make a party out of it and you just have your eggs on ice so that you can always show up and you can have the career that you want. You can meet the men that you want and you can choose your best partner when you're ready to do that. If you want to do that, you just have so many more options.
Do you feel like it puts you on more equal footing with men in terms of the choices that you can make?
Yeah, a little bit. Yeah, men are so lucky in that regard. I was just out hiking with my friend this weekend, and he was just telling me about his what he's planning for his career and when he wants to have kids and these things. And it was just really interesting to just hear his freedom. So much freedom. There is no clock ticking for him, and he can meet a woman whenever he wants to that is the right, as long as she's in a viable fertility age, and have a child. It's no big deal. So yeah, having more freedom is just, it feels great.
Bring us up to date then. What are your plans?
So it's hard to say if this whole experience didn't happen, if I would be in the same position I am now. I am engaged to the man I was dating at the time. I think he really started to look at things differently as he supported me through the egg freezing process, even though, you know, I never put pressure on him. This was my medical experience, my plan for myself. But he received that as an invitation to step up and to step into my life in a new way and trying to have a child naturally. I'm 37 still until March, so that's 38. So I'm still, my eggs should be pretty good naturally, but we're going to give it a try. So we're just going to focus on enjoying our first year of marriage. If we get pregnant, awesome.
And if not, you got a backup plan.
I've got a backup plan. But also, if I'm not that lucky, it will be okay. I will have a fulfilling life if I don't have a child, or if I don't have my own biological child. Like, how great to look at adoption. There's no shortage of ways to be a parent or a mother. There's just so many ways.
Marin Landis works in Seattle. You remember what it's like as a kid to be afraid of something? Those really deep down fears? Well, Dr. Kim Holland took swim lessons as a kid, but she still had this visceral fear of being underwater.
I remember sitting on the edge of the pool and asking Jesus to help me not be afraid in the water. Yeah. I remember loving the waves and being absolutely afraid. Not like a panicky, just, I don't know that I can swim. How will I get my air? How will I stay up?
She carried that fear inside her for decades, into her 50s. But the remarkable thing is that she didn't give up trying. She told her story to reporter Ashley Gross and described how things clicked once she found the right class. And not just clicked in a physical, knowing how to turn your head to take a breath kind of way, but in a much bigger, almost spiritual sense.
Kim Holland has just come out of the locker room at a pool in West Seattle on a Friday morning. It's a little crowded.
It's kind of hard because I don't like it when there's more than one person in a lap lane, because then you got to pay attention and not that the lanes are too narrow.
Nevertheless, she stakes out a lane and climbs in.
Oh, the water's nice and warm. This is amazing.
She would not have been anywhere near the deep end of this pool just 10 years ago. Back then, she was mystified by people who were comfortable in the water, people who didn't fear it like she did.
I knew they knew something that I didn't know. Yeah, and I didn't know how to get it.
If you hear Kim's background, it's hard to imagine her being afraid of anything. She was born in 1954 in New York into a family of civil rights activists.
My mother told me that my first marches were in Flushing, New York, when I was in my pram, in my carriage. When I was two.
By the time she was a teenager, Kim was an activist in her own right. She protested racial and economic injustice and was drawn to the Black Panther Party and their message of self-defense against police brutality. She joined. Their protest chants and rallying speeches by leaders such as Kathleen Cleaver resonated with her.
Black is beautiful!
Hey,
everybody knows that all the people don't have liberties. All the people don't have freedom, and all the people don't have power, so that means none of us do.
These were people who, it seemed to me, were not willing to wait any longer for justice and for freedom. And they were willing to be in the vanguard and to step out and to risk their lives. And that's how I felt.
So here's a young, determined woman fighting for justice, taking part in protests, including one that turned violent. So you see, not a fearful person, but learning to swim, that remained out of reach.
I wanted to learn how to swim. I loved being in the water, but I panicked every time that the water was up above my head.
Kim's fear wasn't unique. Segregation and racism made it difficult for many generations of African Americans to learn to swim. A recent study says almost two-thirds of African American kids have little or no swimming ability. Kim remembers pools being too expensive.
My memories of New York were that you had to have money to go swimming. We didn't have very good means when we lived in New York. We lived in the projects. I had a cousin who went to the Y and learned how to swim. I did not have the availability of a swimming pool.
And she says her parents didn't know how to swim. That almost led to tragedy at the beach one day when her brother got too deep.
I remember all of us on the edge of the beach waiting, wondering what would happen, really watching my brother struggle. And finally a guy that was a white guy swam out and got him and brought him back because none of the adults that were with us knew how to swim well enough to go out and get him.
As Kim grew up and became a mother and a doctor, she wanted to break that cycle. She made sure her daughters learned to swim, and then she became a grandmother, and her grandsons really loved water parks, so she was inspired to try again. Her good friend Elizabeth encouraged her to take lessons, and she found out about something called miracle swimming.
Do you wish you could swim? Do you yearn to swim freely in pool, lake, and ocean? You can.
Melon Dash is the woman who created miracle swimming. Yes, she goes by the name Melon.
It's been my nickname since I was 11, from Mary Ellen, so I just go by it, even though people do a double take.
We're talking on the phone because when I reached her, she was in Hawaii, where she was teaching a snorkeling class. The aim of miracle swimming is to teach afraid adults how to swim. Melon was teaching swimming to a group of college students in New Hampshire decades ago when she realized the water terrified them.
It was clear that they hadn't been given the same steps I had, which were playing. It was playing in the water. It was spending every day of every summer from, 11 a.m. till 7 when the pool closed, playing in the pool with my friends.
So she started to develop a way to first get adults comfortable just being in the water. Melon came up with what she calls the five circles, a way to describe your mental and physical state. She uses pictures to illustrate. In the first circle, there's a stick figure completely inside the circle.
The first circle is centered and grounded, comfortable, calm, self-contained. That's the perfect place to learn.
Each subsequent picture shows the stick figure more and more outside of the circle, and the person feels worse and worse.
The fourth circle is terror, when we are really so afraid that we can't move anymore. And that's why we say in our everyday language that someone is paralyzed by fear or scared stiff.
Fifth circle is a terrible place to be. It's utter panic. So she makes sure her students are always mentally in the first circle, totally comfortable, as they get used to things like putting their heads under the water. Melon says learning how to swim is not about learning to do the crawl. It's about learning to float and stay safe.
And being able to be awake, alert, and enthusiastic in deep water with no qualms about being in deep water, because you know you're not going down. You know the water holds you up, or you know how to stay at the surface and get air when you want it, and you know how to rest.
Kim Holland overcame her fear and learned so well that she now sometimes swims in Puget Sound. But not just that. The idea of staying in the first circle gave her a new way of looking at the world. She says staying calm and centered has helped her deal with trauma from her past, and also during this time of tense racial divisions that she says remind her of the 60s. As a way to help her patients and her community, once a week she helps lead something called Walk and Talk in Seattle's Columbia City neighborhood.
My goodness gracious me, are you here to walk with us? You are? Yes. Oh my word.
She invites her patients and police officers to walk and talk together.
You guys already did your rounds. Huh?
No,
you want to come with us?
We got one more to go. We were waiting for you.
Oh, sweet. Okay.
Kim says exercise is good medicine, and getting to know the police officers helps reduce tensions with law enforcement. One of her patients, an older woman named Pearl Beeman, is here for the walk. I ask her about swimming. She says she's never gotten very comfortable in the water.
I've tried, but I don't go swimming. I think if I'd practice, go back to practice what I used to know I could, but I don't. I feel like I'm too old now.
Kim tells her it's never too late to learn to swim.
There's no reason why you couldn't. And then you could float, and you could do that until you go home to glory. Do you know? Because even if a person can't walk, they can float. Right. Do you know?
Back at the West Seattle pool, Kim's ready to start swimming laps. It's not just exercise. She also uses swimming to practice mindfulness. She does what she calls a body scan, concentrating on one part of her body for each lap.
Up the toes, down the top of the foot, up the ankle, down the calf.
Then she sets off, gliding down the lane, deliberate and smooth. Kim describes being in the water as a total freedom, something meditative.
Sometimes I will do loving kindness. So one lap will be loving kindness to me, and another lap will be loving kindness to my loved ones or to people I don't know. And one lap will be loving kindness to Donald Trump. What used to be loving kindness for Osama bin Laden. As Christians, we're called to do good to those who harm us. It's challenging work, but it needs to be done.
It was challenging work to overcome her fear of water. But Kim says it started an odyssey for her. Staying in the first circle, she says, has allowed her to be more authentic and present. And she'd like to become a swim instructor to help everyone else feel that same way.
That story from reporter Ashley Gross. Orca Swim School in Seattle teaches miracle swimming. In support of the Black Lives Matter movement, the school offers pay-what-you-can classes for African Americans and Native Americans. You can find a link on our website, knkxsoundeffect.org. It's Sound Effect, and today's theme is better late than never. There's that saying that pops up in fortune cookies and spoken by the parents of antsy kids: good things come to those who wait. Michael Jacobson of Seattle waited for something. In fact, he waited for decades to get a hold of two unusual boats that were being used as light fixtures in a restaurant. When it eventually did happen, a new door opened up in the world that he did not expect. Sound Effect's Jennifer Wing has the story.
It's a beautiful, clear Seattle evening, and I'm walking down the front steps of Michael Jacobson's North Seattle home. We maneuver around his car, which is parked in the driveway, and he opens up the garage.
I'm going to open the garage door. Yeah, some guys have Harleys. I have a Tatala.
There's a giant boat. You can barely fit this thing in here.
I can barely fit it in. It is 16 feet in length. It is made up of 21 pieces of wood that have been very carefully custom carved to fit together. There's pegs holding these pieces of wood together. You see the puzzle shaped nature of this. There's no nails, there's no glue.
The Tatalas are built by an indigenous tribe called the Yami. They live on Orchid Island off the coast of Taiwan. Constructing a Tatala is considered to be a rite of passage. A boat is started by a boy, and when he's finished, he's a man. This Tatala in Michael's garage, like all the other Tatalas, was used to catch flying fish with nets. The boat is a work of art. It's ornately carved to look like the prey it's hunting.
These are thought to be the scales of the flying fish. I mean, it looks at one level like a Viking boat, you know?
It does, kind of a miniature version. Level,
yeah.
To understand how this Tatala from thousands of miles away is now in Michael's garage in Seattle, we have to go back to 1986, when Michael and his then-girlfriend, Kara Berman, who's now his wife, were just out of college.
My dad got remarried, and this uncle came from New Zealand, and he's like, oh, come visit, come visit. We had no mortgage, no kids, no pet. And so we were like, we should just do this.
Before going to New Zealand to visit that uncle, Michael and Kara went to Taiwan and to mainland China. They studied the language, the art, the history, and they knew that they were witnessing tremendous change.
You know, the West went through the Industrial Revolution in 100 years, and China was doing it in about 20. So the pace of change was kind of insane and palpable. And yet there's also just things that have been around since the Tang Dynasty, which is 600 to 900 AD. There's a pagoda, and it's a Tang Dynasty pagoda, and it's just standing there in the middle of a park.
Michael and Kara eventually returned to Seattle with a deep knowledge about China and Taiwan. Their lives moved on. They pursued careers in environmental science. And then one day after work, they headed to Ivor's Salmon House at the north end of Lake Union for happy hour.
We walked into this banquet room, and all of a sudden we saw these two boats from what are called the Yami or the Dao people from this island off of Taiwan. And we're like, what? I can't believe these are here. And they were literally being used as hanging light fixtures with fluorescent lights in the boats. And they're hanging from the ceiling. So we're like, that's crazy.
Other carvings and crafts from Taiwan's indigenous tribes were displayed here and there throughout the restaurant, being passed off as Northwest artifacts. Michael got curious. He learned that Ivar Haglund, yes, the Ivar, went to China in the 1970s to buy furniture for the Chinese Room in the Smith Tower, a building he had recently purchased for $1.8 million. Ivar came back with all sorts of treasures, including the two Tatala canoes. Over the years, Michael kept going back to Ivor's Salmon House. It was like his own personal Taiwanese art museum. He'd always look up to make sure that the Tatalas were still there, these boats that took him to his time in Taiwan and represented old traditions hanging on in a fast-changing part of the world. Then, one day, after nearly 30 years of many beers and orders of fish and chips, the canoes, they were gone.
And I was like, oh my God. Maybe they sold them. Maybe they threw them away. Maybe they had a bonfire.
The Tatalas were fine. They were in a warehouse filled with old restaurant decorations and fat fryers. And it was around this time that Michael came into a little bit of money after his mom died. So he went to Ivar's and made a deal for the boats.
I gave him a number that I thought was not insulting, and they needed a rug for their headquarters. So I gave him a number that basically paid for the rug. It worked out.
After all of these years that have passed, these canoes built to catch flying fish in the warm waters of the South China Sea, they were now Michael's. One remains in his garage, and the other Tatala, the one that's in better shape, Michael donated to the Burke Museum in Seattle. And this is where this nearly 30-year journey takes a new turn. You see, Michael's friend, an anthropologist, knows this researcher who knows a man named Simon Laverman, who is from the island, Orchid Island, where these canoes are made. And he happens to be in Seattle this past summer. And a children's choir from Taiwan also happens to be in Seattle at the same time. They all meet at the Burke's warehouse, where Simon blessed this new addition to the collection.
The way that he talked about the boat was not as an object. He talked about the boat as a person. They're basically talking to the boat saying, you've had a long life. You need to rest. You're in a good place. They will take care of you here. And we know you're far away from your home, but it's okay. You'll be okay.
Did the thought cross your mind at the time of the blessing when you have people visiting from Taiwan who have this legitimate connection to this boat? I need to give this to you. This doesn't belong here.
Well, yes, it did. Because, you know, what's the proper place for this? But that wasn't their focus. They saw it, frankly, as an emissary of their culture. There's a broader collective good here.
Michael says he is going to go to Orchid Island to see where his Tatalas come from. And Simon Laverman is already making plans to return to Seattle. The hope is that when he comes again, he'll be bringing a brand new Tatala that will explore the waters of the Pacific Northwest.
That story from Sound Effects, Jennifer Wing. So there's this online test where the faces of people of different races flash up on your screen, along with words like good, bad, sweet, bitter, And then you have to immediately click on one of the words when you see the face. It tests our implicit racial biases in a way that's really hard to fool. The results can be enlightening, or horrifying, because it turns out that most of us have implicit bias. Dr. Caprice Hollins teaches workshops that help people confront their prejudices, even when they've been unaware of them. And that is something that Hollins understands. She says her own family is so diverse that she always figured she couldn't be biased.
My mom is white. I have four older brothers and sisters that are white from my mom's first marriage. I have a brother who's gay that I always knew was gay. I didn't know what gay was, but it was clear this brother was different from other boys. I have black grandparents who legally adopted my mom when she was 41 years old, and a dad who married a woman from Thailand, and a brother who's a Republican, and I can go on and on.
But as an adult, Hollins began to see herself a little differently. She discovered that even she harbors biases. And that led to a lifelong commitment to being honest about her baggage and helping other people do the same.
For my entire life, from as long as I can remember, there was often tension between me and black girls as a child and later black women. And I never understood that tension. So once I realized and was able to embrace that I have privilege as a light-skinned multiracial woman, which I'd never heard of before graduate school, that I benefit simply because of the color of my skin, and shifted from this narrative of me too, my experience is the same because I'm black, to yes, I experience oppression, but there are also some different things about the ways in which, you might experience oppression that I don't.
And what did it feel like to have those realizations about yourself and your own attitudes? Was it uncomfortable for you in some ways?
I call them hurt so good moments. Right? So, yeah, it is hard. And, you know, so Ilse and I, my business partner, we take people through awareness workshops. That's one of the categories of this work. And this is where people are doing really difficult work to look at where they've been socialized, what are the messages that they've received, kind of deconstructing and reconstructing a new identity. And we tell people this is the hardest work you can do because you've spent a lifetime developing a sense of who you see yourself to be. My best friend is, I have children who are, I work with someone who is, I dated someone once, you know, and so those become our narratives of who we see ourselves to be.
Are people who are that far along still able to change?
Yeah, you know, this is kind of a sad story, but I remember working with an organization. They brought me in over time. I got to do 4 intensive days with them. And there was an older gentleman, retired, and he really struggled in the beginning. And as the time is going on and I keep coming back, I'm watching him shift. By the 3rd workshop, he would talk about how he was having conversations with people that he knew, what was looking different for him, how he was seeing things differently. And then by the 4th workshop, I had found out that he had died. And I always think about how people will say to me, well, you know, that's an older generation. My grandparents are never going to change. But the idea that change can't happen because you're at a certain age, in my mind, is kind of ridiculous.
And it seems like you have to be pretty motivated to do it.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah. Frances Kendall, in her book Unpacking White Privilege, says white people have to know what's in it for them in order to do this work. Whereas people of color, we really don't have a choice. Right. I have children I have to think about. I have a senior in high school that's over 6'4" wearing size 16 wide shoes. I got to talk to him about when he leaves that front door.
How do you talk about these issues with him and with the particular position that he's in as a person of color who is physically imposing, who might face a lot of assumptions out in the world?
I also have a 17-year-old son and I have a 15-year-old daughter. And so the conversations with my son, and I'll give you some examples in a moment, are more around how the world is going to see you as a black man. You don't get to just be Matei. So he's more likely to be seen as a threat. with my daughter, the conversations are more around counter narratives, right? It's meaning that she's more likely to get the message that because of her height, because of her size, because of her skin tone, the texture of her hair, that she's not beautiful. So with her, it's more around wanting her to know that in spite of what the world or who the world tells you that you are, here's who you are. So it's really great now where my kids are at. The other day, my brother does like computer repairs. And so, you know, I told him, hey, you know, the kids are off for the summer. How about if we pay them to go around and put flyers on people's cars, right? So I hand them these flyers. My son can now drive. I'm telling him, you go to the Fred Meyers or what have you, go to the parking lot, start putting these flyers on cars. And my son says, well, Mom, you know, what if someone thinks I'm tampering with their car? So this is the way I want him to think, right? I want him to imagine what are the potential ways in which people might view him as a Black man walking around to the different cars. And this is the added burden that I have as a parent. And this is the added burden that he's going to have to learn to carry as a Black man. And by the way, you don't have to be a big, tall, you know, 6'4" Black man to worry about those things. So now he's talking with me about it as well. And so I feel success.
And finally, this may seem phenomenally like ridiculous question, totally self-evident, but what is it that motivates you and make you want to do this work with professionals, with people who are adults who maybe didn't come out and seek it out? Why is it so important to you?
Yeah, when you ask that question, and I think maybe I feel emotional because you just asked me about my children. And I always, you know, I know Gabriel intellectually, I usually can answer this question and say, well, it's for my children. But I think the emotion is just because it is so real for me that I don't get to just parent my children. I don't get to just say, what school will they go to? You know, what hairstyle will they go out and put this flyer on the car? Like, there's so much more energy and work. And I am so deathly afraid of the what ifs, that my fear is that if white people, that good, kind, loving, moral, ethical white person, doesn't get that racism still exists, and it still exists in such a way that we are seeing disparities and disproportionality in education and healthcare. And, you know, the idea that my son is likely to be shot first and then will ask the questions about why he was there or what he was doing. If I don't get white folks in this work with me, then my children's children will experience the same thing, that my children will have to educate their children. And it will just continue, because I think that the harm of racism today in many ways is just as dangerous as the racism that existed in the 60s. It's just looking different, and it is getting harder to prove, but we're still seeing what's happening to people of color's health and what's happening in education and who's locked up in the prisons. And I'm just so afraid. I am so afraid for my children. Yeah.
Well, Caprice Hollins is co-founder of Cultures Connecting, which does consulting and coaching work around recognizing and overcoming bias and prejudice. Thank you so much for being on our show.
Thank you, Gabriel.
You're tuned to Sound Effect on KNKX. I'm Gabriel Spitzer, and all of our stories this week touch on the idea of better late than never. So Washington State, of course, is named after founding father George Washington. But there's another George Washington, also a founding father, who settled in a little corner of the territory with his wife Mary Jane nearly 150 years ago. He created a town called Centerville, which was later changed to Centralia. Now, what makes Washington an unusual pioneer type is that he was African American. People in Centralia have long honored their unique founder. And now, 200 years after his birth, they want the rest of the world to give him the recognition he deserves, too. Brian Mitke is chairman of the city's Bicentennial Committee, and he told me about Washington's exceptional story.
So we're in George Washington Park now, a brick plaza by an American flag, and there is a big stone monument here. It's presented in 1976, and it tells the story of George Washington. It says George Washington, founder, first citizen, humanitarian. He was born in Virginia. His mom was white, and his dad was a black slave. His dad was sold right after George was born, and his mom just faced this heartbreaking choice. She knew that her son would certainly face a life of slavery, and so she gave him to a white couple named James and Anna Cochran to raise as their own. They went west of the American frontier, and George was raised as a pioneer man. He learned how to shoot and you know, skin game and sew his own clothes. And they ended up going to Missouri, and he became a young businessman, but he faced real racial obstacles. There are laws that prevented him from operating his business as a free man. He told his family, his white foster family, in 1850, he said, "I'm going west. If there is a decent place in this world, I'm going to find it." The reason he came to Centralia is it was far enough from the seat of territorial government in the Oregon Territory that he thought that he could sort of fly under the radar a little bit, have some land. And so he lived here in Centralia for the rest of his life, founded the town, became its leading citizen. And it's really exciting to be standing here in the park that he donated to the town that he founded. And we're actually going to work on putting a statue of him in. Actually, this is the first time I've seen it. That bench right there, can we go over and look at it?
Yeah, of course.
So this is really cool. One of our businessmen here, he donated this bench to us. It's a granite marble bench. And right here, we're going to put a statue of George Washington standing, his wife Mary Jane sitting, their dog smiling next to them. And then we're going to leave an open space here for anybody who wants to sit down and just sit with George and Mary Jane, because they were accessible people and, you know, can take a selfie with George and Mary Jane Washington. Things are moving. 200 years after George's birth, we're trying to honor him in a exciting way.
In the course of studying him and preparing for this bicentennial celebration and kind of getting to know him across the historical distance, have there been moments or things that you've learned, little bits or pieces that have made him kind of come alive in full color for you, have made him really like a human being and not like some historical figure in the dusty pages of a book?
Yeah, George had some sort of fever when he was in his 30s and he lost all his hair, so he was completely bald. And he would wear a brown wig as he walked through town, but on Sundays he would put on a black wig just to dress up a little bit more. And he would sing at the top of his voice as he walked through town, and one of his favorite songs is called Salem's Bright King. And he would just sing the top of his lungs. You could hear him from one end of Centerville to the other, is what they said. It's a very haunting, beautiful, old-time hymn that he had learned growing up from his foster parents.
Just such a worthless worm as I, who sometimes am afraid to die, who sometimes am afraid to die, be found at thy right hand.
There's a story that he had some paper money at one time and some wind blew it into the fire from an open window, and so he never trusted paper money after that. He only wanted hard currency coin. And so he took a bunch of money out of one of the local banks, and there's a story of him wheelbarrowing it down the road. And some say he buried it and it was never found. It's a good story. I don't know if it's true, but it's possible that there's buried treasure from the founder of Centralia still hidden somewhere in the town. I'd appreciate if people didn't come down here and start digging holes, but you never know.
So was he always a revered and popular figure? I mean, as when he was founding the town, what did the other settlers think of this African-American guy who had some means, who was the landlord around here?
In one case, a neighbor who had moved in, we're talking the 1850s before the Civil War, didn't like having his property butt up to a black man's property. So this gentleman set his fences back 6 feet so his fences wouldn't touch. So George, who was pretty even-tempered, but he wouldn't suffer fools, he moved his fences back 6 feet as well. So that 12-foot space between their fences became one of the early city streets. But a better story, I think, is someone moved into the lot next to him. This guy didn't want to live next to a black man either, so he put up a big wall or a big fence in between their properties. But quickly he got to know George, would go to visit him so often that he cut a hole in the wall so it was easier to visit his friend.
Can you say more about why you care so much about the legacy of this person and why you want other people to know about it? What does he mean to you personally?
He was the type of person I want to be. He had a saying that I want to do right by my fellow man, and if I do that, I'll always come out ahead. And he did. During this horrible recession of the 1890s, when people couldn't pay their bills, he said, "That's okay, I know you're good for it." And he would let bills go for years, and when they could pay, they did. One of the guys who had known George back in the 1890s lived into the 1970s, and so we have recordings of this guy saying, "George Washington was the best man I ever knew."
A lot of people owed him on property. He never closed in. He never hurt nobody. He would go to Portland and get food stuff and everything to help people out. Mm-hmm. I've seen some good people, but I'm never better man than old George Washington.
Our town, you know, certainly isn't perfect, but we still know George, and we are excited to celebrate his memory and, you know, consider ourselves his heirs and part of his legacy. We're proud of that.
Alongside Brian Mitke on the Bicentennial Committee sits Pastor Alan Woods. That was his daughter, Shana, we heard singing that hymn. As we chat in George Washington Park, with some fairly unsavory-looking dudes stalking around the trees, Woods confronts an unspoken part of this celebration. George Washington represents a Centralia before its current hard times.
You know, I think is what everyone see is so bad. I've been reading a lot of articles about the best places to live in Washington and the best states. And Washington State ranked number 5 as states to live in, while Centralia ranked number 2 in Washington State as the worst city to live in. But you know what though? There's a lot of work that we can do to improve, you know, our community. And we're not gonna do it by ignoring the problem. We face it head on and we move at it. And I think George Washington's story is the catalyst to bringing us to an understanding of the way things were and the way that they can be again.
So Centralia has its issues, right? But you feel like this has something to say about its issues today, even though this is a story, it's a 200-year-old story?
Yes, I think it's a positive issue. If you never understand what your problems are and where you are, then you'll never know where you need to go. So Centralia has an advantage because it's seen better times. So why not use that to say, hey, listen, we can continue in this.
Since we first ran this story, the Bicentennial Committee raised the money to pay for the statue with the unveiling and dedication on August 11th. And that may be today, depending on when you're listening. And a heads up that our KNKX Connect series continues from Centralia this month, when 88.5's All Things Considered team will be broadcasting live from there August 30th. Sound Effect is produced by Kevin Kniestead and Jennifer Wing with Bethany Denton. We had help this week from Shane Mailing, Allie Ferguson, Kyle Norris, Ashley Gross, and Jackson Main. Parker Miles Blom contributes visuals, and our executive producer is Aaron Hennessy. We're back next week when our theme is ghosts. I'm Gabriel Spitzer, and this is 88.5 KNKX.